So today we're going to talk about metal nanoparticles. I want to go through some of, on a very high level, some of the ways they're manufactured. They have some very interesting and useful properties. I know you've, in this various surveys, have touched on those. And then out of those interesting properties, I want to touch on some examples of products that are available today in the market. I think it's important to talk a little bit about the history of synthetic metal nanoparticles, because it does teach you something about the stepwise approach that's kind of led to nanoscience as we know it today, and definitions. I'm going to get into that a little bit more than I think most people would, because there are implications in the business world on around the definition of nanomaterials, and I'll expand on that a little bit. The methods of manufacture, I know you've had some discussion on the top down and bottom up. I'll get into that some more. Specific to metal nanoparticles, properties, and some products, including products that Nano Horizons currently has on the market. I know that you've heard about Faraday, but it really was the launching point for conceptually a lot of the ideas that are at the core of nanoscience today. At the time, the gold nanoparticles that he developed were referred to as sols, but the key idea is one that is still kind of embodied in nanoscience 101, and that is that as you shrink materials, you start to see unique phenomena. In this case, they didn't have a clear idea of what the size ranges were, but they understood that variations in the sizes of these particles that they had created gave rise to a variety of resultant colors. So they understood that there were the optical properties that we've discussed. There wasn't fantastic control, but there was a degree of control because it was reproducible. And here on the side is a slide that is from the original Faraday lectures from 1857 that are still stable today and still in a museum. But again, there wasn't the suite of characterization techniques available to fully understand what they were doing. And it was 100 years later when Turkovich, with the advent of the electron microscope, was really able to dissect what Faraday had done at the next level. And when they reproduced Faraday's synthesis, which was a silver chloride that had been reduced chemically, they found that they were 6 nanometer gold particles with a very narrow distribution, plus or minus 2 nanometers. So it's very impressive from a chemical standpoint. They were able to do it. It took about 100 years for us as scientists to be able to fully understand what was done there. Close to home here in Philadelphia, a photo enthusiast named Matthew Carey Lee developed the first robust synthesis of colloidal silver in the 1880s. And silver chemistry in the early days is very much a story of photographic chemistry. Silver chlorides were the basis for all early photographic film. And it was photo reduction of the silver chlorides into silver particles, and then you fix those. That's the key to photography. And so there was a lot of chemistry going on in the world of silver. And Matthew Carey Lee's manual on photography, he describes a synthesis of making very finely divided silver particles known as colloidal silver. And because they had a characteristic yellow color that was very intense, they worked very well as an optical filter. So you could put them in a film and they would absorb in the blue, so you had the yellow transmitted. And the colloidal silver using the Carey Lee synthesis is still used today in certain X-ray films. And again, like with Faraday, it took a considerable amount of time for scientists to fully understand what they'd done. And again, it was the advent of electron microscopy, in this case TEM, that allowed characterization of the silver particles. And so the size range is, as you can see, it's a fairly uniform particle size, 7 to 10 nanometers. And, this is really confirmation that some of the methodologies, and this again was precipitation of silver salts, had been well established in the 1880s, but it took a long time to get the characterization down. Again, in Philadelphia, a gentleman named Alfred Barnes took a synthesis very similar to the synthesis that Carrie Lee came up with silver nanoparticles, and he developed a product called Argyrol. And before penicillin, before antibiotics, around the turn of the century here until 1950, we have 4850, this product in particular, but there are a number of other silver-based compounds, were the antiseptic that was used throughout the United States. So before there was penicillin or methicillin or any of the other antibiotics, silver particles were used not only as a topical antiseptic for a wound, but to treat colds, to treat sinus infections. And so Alfred Barnes, who developed this antiseptic silver, he amassed an incredible fortune. And I'm not sure if anyone here has ever heard of the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, but I forget how many billions of dollars worth of French Impressionist art is currently in the Barnes Foundation Museum. But it was $2 or $3 billion worth of art. And it was all amassed with a fortune that came from selling silver nanoparticles in the early 1900s. So it's a very interesting story. Some people say, well, how do you really know that they were silver nanoparticles? Well, one of the reasons we know is because you can actually still find bottles of this product that have been sitting on shelves for 80 years. I actually bought a bottle of Argyrol that was manufactured in 1942 on eBay for $5 just because I wanted to stick it in the DLS and see what the particle size distribution was. And this is the data that came from it. It was an average particle size of about 30 nanometers. From a government regulatory side, before the FDA had responsibility for regulating drugs, there were products like this that were on the market. And part of the FDA regulation, when that was introduced, said that those products could continue on the market. So there are grandfathered products that have been on the market continuously since before there was an FDA. And this is one of those products. So you can actually go to Argyrol.com and you can buy this product that's prepared using the same formulations that was used in 1902. And it's kind of become a little bit of a holistic medicine option for some people. There are certainly more targeted antibiotics for specific bacterial infections now. But what's interesting is this product's been on the market continuously for over 110 years now. And as I said, it's 30 nanometer particles. At one point, there were over 2 million prescriptions of this product written each year in the United States. So our understanding about human toxicity in silver nanoparticles has a much deeper and earlier history than I think most people appreciate. Because you do have, when you're talking about medical products, I'll discuss a little later some medical products that use silver nanoparticles. And periodically, you'll get someone at FDA who's reviewing the product and saying, what's going to happen when a silver nanoparticle gets on someone's skin? And we can say, well, there's actually quite a bit of history to draw from going back over 100 years. This is an advertisement from 1942 that shows a little boy getting silver nanoparticles up his nose to help get rid of his cold. And compared to iodine and other antiseptics that were available on the market, it was less irritating, and that's what made it quite popular. So through that whole kind of history of metal nanoparticles, I kept repeating synthetic in the titles there, And the reason I did that is because there is a distinction to be made, because metal nanoparticles can actually form in nature. They've been observed in soil samples from places that have human waste, but also in places that haven't really been impacted by people at all. From a geochemistry standpoint, it's just beginning to become clear as to how those things occur. And it turns out that if you have silver salt that leaches from some type of soil, simple reduction by something like humic acid under the right conditions, you'll spontaneously form silver nanoparticles in the environment. So just to make the distinction, the history of silver nanoparticles or other metallic particles there's a geohistory there, but we want to talk about the things that we can control in the laboratory. But I did find this interesting that under natural conditions, you can also form these very small particles. So any questions on history? Definitions are important, and from the viewpoint of someone in industry, they're becoming increasingly important. And one of the common concepts that is wrapped up in definition of what's a nanomaterial or nanoparticle is the degree of confinement or the dimensionality of the material. So a bulk material, of course, is not going to have nanostructures, and so there's no confinement in a quantum sense. If you have something that's planar, like mica, which is naturally occurring, you can get one-dimensional confinement. And then as you get into wires, two-dimensional confinement, and then we're talking about particles today, which have the highest degree of confinement, three-dimensional confinement. And there's not a consensus on at what point in this transition you go from nano to not. And typically, you wouldn't think that's so important, except there's a lot of activity around defining nanomaterials right now in a lot of different compartments around the globe. So this is actually a bit of a dated reference from 2010. But in 2010, there were 24 different nano-related definitions that had been proposed by different standards organizations and most commonly governmental agencies around the globe. This is, if I put the full list here, it'd go down into the second floor. But just starting with A and going down through, this is how, for this particular reference, they decided to organize the nano definitions. So there's a question of, what size limits do we want to discuss? In some cases, as you know, it's below 100. Sometimes it's 1 to 100. Here this case, it's less than 200. And in an informal setting, that's not really a big deal. You have added complexity when you talk about two or three dimension versus one dimension, as we were discussing on the last page. In some agencies, there's a reference to whether or not it's manufactured versus naturally occurring. There's another column that's not on here that's become important to manufacturers, and that's intentionally manufactured versus unintentionally manufactured, which to me is a hard concept to wrap my brain around. If I'm a manufacturer, I should be intentionally manufacturing things. But in fact, there are U.S. government agencies that are starting to say, well, we're going to have a regulatory framework around nanomaterials. And if you didn't intentionally make a nanomaterial, then you don't have to register it. But if you intentionally manufactured it as nano, you're going to have to go through added regulations. And so when you start to see whether or not it's soluble, in some cases matters, and in others it doesn't. There's this kind of self-referential, does it have unique properties, yes or no? So it's only a nanomaterial if it has unique properties at the nanoscale, but with no definition of unique. in some cases, none of these definitions, but others say it has to have a certain dimensionality to it and a certain surface area where if you're above a certain number of meter square per gram, then it's defined as a nanomaterial. And then combinations, unique properties, even if it's above or below the 1 or 100 nanometers. So this is complicated. Now, typically that wouldn't be a big deal, but one of the things that we're starting to see in industry is each of these government bodies starting to promulgate its own regulations around what has to be done to put products on the market. And so you may have a completely different set of requirements in one continent versus another because the definitions change. But there are some people that are looking at this and trying to step back from this definition alphabet soup. Professor Andrew Maynard from University of Michigan's Risk Science Center has kind of called a timeout and said, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here, in the sense that, so we developed these definitions of nanomaterials, 1 to 100 nanometers, and we did that because it's useful to spur innovation. It's useful that, hey, you know, we want to cluster things like lithography and electron microscopy, and we're going to talk about the nanoscale as as something that draws those things together. So it spurs innovation. The problem is whenever you start saying, okay, anything that's 1 to 100 nanometers is going to have unique properties. And because it's unique, our historical understanding of what's safe and what's not doesn't apply. So we're going to assume that anything that falls within this definition, and that definition can change from, you know, one country to the next, one agency to the next within a country. We're going to make certain assumptions about whether it's safe or not. And so here's the key thing is you've got regulations that are currently in development all around the globe around nanomaterials that are all the central theme is that there's a thought that things that are in this range have a singular set of either benefits or risks attached to them and can be regulated as a group. And when we understand the complexity of nanoscience and what's in and what's out, and you see how the definitions can change, you get to the point where these generally accepted definitions, when you try to use them to add new regulations, the system breaks down because you can't agree what's in, you can't agree what's out. The one driving force behind all this is the assumption that these things are new. If it's nano, it's new. We just got done talking about how some of the products have been on the market for 120 years. So it's not a straightforward issue. The only reason I wanted to bring it up here was it's impactful to business. It's impactful to how grants are being distributed at the federal level. You're seeing a significant more research being put into risks, which is positive because you have to clearly identify where risks are so you don't have issues in commerce. But at the same time, you've got these overlaying regulations that really do threaten the commercialization of some innovation, which is ultimately its jobs. The value of the output here at the university is going to be established in the marketplace beyond the educational part that we bring. But ultimately, if you really want to see all the wonderful applications come together, it's got to be done in a thoughtful regulatory framework. And right now, definitions are impeding that. So any questions on the complexity of regulations and definitions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you have an example of like the difference of unintentionally versus intentionally manufactured nanomaterials?
I do. Oh. It's troublesome. In 1954, there was a product that was based on silver nanoparticles that was first commercialized for use as an algaecide. And so silver does a very good job of preventing the growth of bacteria and fungus and algae. And so that product was registered with the USDA And then later, EPA took over that. So that product's been in commerce for 60 years. Every 15 years, the EPA has to review the products like algicides that are on the market, make sure that they're still considered safe. And so that product, which is 7-nanometer particle, has been on the market for 50 years. The manufacturer stated to EPA that they never meant to make nanoparticles. And because they never meant to make nanoparticles, they shouldn't have to deal with any new potential regulations around nanoscience. And the agency is sympathetic to that view, except for the fact that they have patents from the 1950s that show that the algicides really don't work unless it's 7 millimicron, which is what the term that was used before a nanometer. In the old literature, you'll find reference to millimicrons, which is equivalent to a nanometer. That's an example where the manufacturer said, we never meant to make a nanoparticle. We're making colloids. And the regulatory agencies are sympathetic to that view. To me, the problem is that you could have a new entry into the market manufacturing the same product and do it in a very deliberate way where you engineer this algicide to be maximally efficient. You characterize it very thoroughly using a TEM, and they could have identical products in the market, and one would be subject to regulation because they did it using contemporary science. The one that's been on the market for a long time and didn't have a lot of characterization done in the last 20 years, you'd have an unequal playing field in terms of the regulations. And when I talk about the regulations, and it does make sense. So they want to make sure that human toxicity, aquatic toxicity, avian toxicity. So I want to make sure that if a bird comes down and lands in the swimming pool that's got this algicide, that they're going to be safe. You have to generate hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of data. And so for a nanomaterial, at this point, it's looking like it's going to be millions of dollars per product versus tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars for a non-nano product. So the discrepancy in cost to get through these regulatory hurdles is hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. And it's problematic to have fuzzy definitions like this when you have those type of differences in the costs associated with moving through the regulations. So for about 15 years now, you know, we've talked about different ways to manufacture the nanoscale, and this construct is one that's held up over time, I think. There are a lot of variations on it, but the top-down, bottom-up approach really does, I think, do a nice job of helping categorize the general strategies for manufacturing nanomaterials and metal nanoparticles in particular. So, of course, the top-down is you start with a bulk material and you apply some type of a process to it to make it smaller. The bottom up is we start with atoms or molecules, and we do an assembly process to create a nanoscale material that has a desired functionality to it. So, and I'll apologize in advance. I know that the science has broadened, and there have been so many clever ways to generate nanomaterials that the bulleted points I'm bringing up don't even come close to touching all the different ways that have been developed to do top-down and bottom-up, but I think these are somewhat accurate. When we do talk about things like milling, where you start with a bulk material and you grind it, but in reality, for metal particles, very rarely can you mill a material to get it down to the nanoscale. It's much more common to use a technique like sputtering or laser ablation or some type of e-beam deposition, where we start with a large metal target and we chip away chunks of it with some type of energy that's in flux into the target. So there are a number of ways to do that. One of the examples I give here is a product called Acticoat. This is a wound dressing. It's the standard of care for infected wounds and burn wounds around the globe. It's produced by an English company called Smith & Nephew. And the manufacturing approach is to do a sputtering technique where they start with a silver target. They take the wound care bandage and they set it inside of a sputtering chamber, and they deposit very small particles of silver over the course of 14 hours is how long it takes to manufacture. So it's a costly product, but if you compare it to a fast sputter, high energy sputter, where you get higher crystallization and larger particles, you get this has a much, much lower efficacy in terms of the antibacterial properties that are desired in the wound dressing. So on a microscopic level, those are the differences you get, but it has a real clinical benefit. So another common industrial technique is pulsed wire evaporation. I'll talk about that a little bit more. And then, of course, nanolithography is a technique that I think is really in its infancy, but I think is going to be very important long term. It's a little bit of a challenge with metals because if you compare it to something like silicon, it's a much greater challenge to evaporate and deposit because it's got the, of course, low vapor pressure. So you've got to work with various etchants and have some clever ways to deal with metals. It's a little bit more of a challenge than your semiconductors, for example. But it can be done. So some of these techniques like pulsed wire evaporation can be very inexpensive. Most of these at this point, there are good ways to scale them, with the exception of some of the sputtering techniques really do require a number of batch reactors, depending upon what type of uniformity you're trying to get on your target. So one of the, and then of course, if you're talking about a technique that uses a target, starting out with a pure target should give you pure nanoparticles. So in practice, there are lots of ways that you can get impurities into your vacuum chamber. I think if you spend enough time dealing with vacuum chambers, you've had that happen. On the con side, control can be an issue with a number of these techniques. Shape and geometry, and then, of course, oxidation and impurities can be an issue with any of these techniques. So here's a nice flow diagram for a commercial nanopowder maker that's based on the pulsed wire evaporation methodology. And I apologize here that it's not the most clear graphic, but what you start with is a coil of metal wire. And it's fed through an annulus into a chamber, and then you have a pulse energy source that, I'm trying to see, the explosion chamber is down here, but more or less you arc the wire and you explode it into tiny bits. You pull a vacuum on it, and you go through this blower and you collect the powder here, you filter it out, and you pump back through. So if you think about a very high energy pulse exploding a wire, you do that continuously and you continue to feed the wire into the system and you drive the pulse and you explode it. So it's a bit of a chaotic technique because you end up with a really wide particle size distribution, but you can really crank some nanoparticles using this technique. It's basically you're driving your wire in there. You put a ton of energy in, you explode the wire, and you pull it off and collect the powder, and you can just run it continuously. So it's not a batch process, which is what makes it very, very high throughput. So you can also do additional surface modification subsequently, but that's not inherent in this flow process that's shown here. So those were the top down. On the bottoms up, and with metal nanoparticles, if I had to venture a guess, I'd say it's fairly evenly split in between materials that are being manufactured from a top down approach versus a bottom up approach. You probably have more commoditized materials being produced using methods like the pulsed wire explosion. Your very highly engineered nanoparticles are typically going to be produced using some of these chemical methods. with the exception of things like nanolithography, which obviously can be very highly engineered. So, liquid phase synthesis, this is what Faraday did, right? He started with a silver chloride salt and did a chemical. You have to be careful with language. I want to call it a chemical precipitation, but it's a colloid, so it's got a negative charge that prevents the particles from agglomerating and they stay in solution. So chemists would want to call it a precipitation, but it doesn't actually fall to the bottom of your liquid beaker because of the repulsive effects. So, so it's a chemical reduction to produce your colloids. Electrochemical reduction just uses electrochemistry instead of a chemical reducing agent. And as I was looking at this the other day, I realized I was remiss in not also mentioning photochemical reduction. As we were already talking about, especially with silver, photochemical reduction goes back to the beginning of photographic chemistry. And there are a number of very elegant syntheses that have been described in the literature over the last 15 years, especially combinations of polymers and metals that use photoreduction to grow discrete nanoparticles, using the same ideas that were used in photographic chemistry 100-some years ago. So, but those are general approaches. But all of these consistently start with some type of a metal salt that's in an aqueous solution, and then you chemically reduce it into the metal. Vapor phase synthesis is a little bit more complex. You can get CVD methods, chemical vapor deposition methods. Again, you've got to really understand the limitations around the various metal precursors, organometallic precursors that are used there. And then flame paralysis is a method that we see growing quite a bit, and I'll give some examples of that later. And then when you get into the more engineered devices, you start to see methods that do that self-assemble. Either you'll have individual atoms that assemble into particles, or particles into discrete clusters. So relative to some of the top-down approaches, you can get very good control of your size distribution. And depending upon other polymers that are introduced, you can get very nice shape control in some systems. The cons is that, so if we think about something like Faraday's system, where we started with a silver salt, we add a chemical reducing agent to it, and we manufacture silver particles that are suspended in aqueous solution, we've got the counter ion from your reducing agent that's also hanging out there with it. And you need that because you need to counterbalance the charge that's on the colloidal particle. But if you wanted to then isolate those silver particles into a powder, they're co-mixed with the counter ions that were used to manufacture it. So there are some limitations that come with the entrainment of the counter ions that occurs. And also, I'll talk a little bit about approaches to manufacturing the nanoparticles in solution. There are some limits on scalability because of the methods that are being used and the importance of being diffusion limited in the manufacturing process. So here's Faraday's gold colloids, and it's a straightforward salt in the presence of a reducing agent to make a nanoparticle, and there they are. You can see that you get some rods mixed in, and you get some triangles mixed in, it's not always clear if this is spurred by an impurity or if it has to do with how it's seeded. But you do get a mix using some of these methodologies. And just to show kind of how complex and the number of different inputs that can be used, this is a table from 2004. And if you were to write this table in 2014, there would probably be 10 times the number of entries here. But these are, aside from the anodes, if you look at these salts, these are very common salts that are used to manufacture silver nanoparticles. Here, your common reducing agents. And polymer stabilizers are quite commonly added to limit the rate of diffusion of the particles, so you get discrete nucleation, you get a large number of particles in a small size range. They're also very useful in preventing agglomeration after you do the manufacturing. But the thing to think about is if you take all the metals, if you make a three-dimensional grid where you take all the metals, all the different reducing agents, and all the different stabilizers, and you say, you know, what's the combination here? You get a massive number of combinations that are going to have different compositions, size, crystal structures. So that's distinct from shape. You know, you can have your different crystal structures and different shape, your zeta potential, the overall reactivity, solubility. All of these things will change based on the combination of these. And so there's a ton of intellectual property that's already been developed, but there's even more opportunity to develop new materials. And we're going to go through some of those examples where people have, through combinations of these, been able to come up with very, very unique metal nanoparticles and commercialize them successfully. So to really properly get into this tangent requires a lot of time, but there are two general methods to high dispersion when you look at bottom-up synthesis in aqueous or solvent solutions. One of the general approaches is the thermodynamic equilibrium approach, where you're actually growing your metal nanoparticles under equilibrium conditions. And it starts with supersaturating a solution. Then there's a seeding and nucleation process. And then in a very controlled way, you get growth of the particles. And that's a very elegant way to grow a series of particles. And if you were looking at optical properties or whatnot, you can get very, very nice controlled growth. It's typically done more for research-based materials. You don't see this as commonly for commercial commodity materials from our experience, because it takes a lot of in-process controls to manage it well, and it doesn't scale particularly well. A more common approach is a kinetic approach, where you limit the amount of metal salt that you're going to put in there. Typically, a polymer is added to confine the precursor into a certain area. Then you add your reducing agent, and you get diffusion-limited growth of the particles. The former's typically going to give you better control than the latter, but you can, in some cases, have very good control here. This part of confining into a limited space with some type of templating agent is the key to figuring out whether or not you're going to get a nice, a very high degree of monodisparity or not. So this in itself can be expanded to a whole topic, but it's something that I've noticed over the years. I've looked at the approaches that have been used in aqueous and non-aqueous synthesis, that you're basically going to fall into one of these two categories. And some people have done some nice presentations on this over time. So getting into another bottom-up technique that I mentioned earlier that I see growing quickly is flame spray pyrolysis. And the general approach is you've got your precursor that comes through a nebulizer. You're usually mixing it with hydrogen or some other flammable source. You get nucleation as you get cooling, and then based on how rapidly you quench it, you can get different degrees of agglomeration and coagulation. And it's pretty surprising, by controlling this property and, of course, the rate of inlet and then also the composition of the gas, you can get a very high diversity of materials using this technique. And again, because it's a continuous process, not a batch process, it can be very, very cost effective. Taking it to the next level, you can do combination flame synthesis where So this is a methodology for producing palladium catalysts on aluminum, on alumina. And they have the basically a metal flame and a support flame, and they quench in the same zone. And by adjusting the flow rate of the metal, you can get particle sizes that range from 2 nanometers up to 5.5. And then, of course, the dispersion of the particles changes. But you can tune it to a degree. And then, of course, because this is a catalyst, the third thing you'd want to do is run your catalytic reaction and optimize along these two axes. But, you know, to me, this is a very, this is an elegant industrial way to approach some of these synthesis methods. We're doing combinations where you're simultaneously synthesizing 2 nanomaterials at once. By quenching them in the same zone right here, you can produce complex materials. And then, this is a relatively old paper, but it's a, to me, it's fascinating, from 1996. And in graduate school, this is something that we would have called a hero experiment, where you basically you, so this is a, and this is an anode. You, generate, you atomize metal here. So this is going to be top down. Then you control the temperature through a furnace and you start to agglomerate particles through here. And so at that point, it starts to move bottom up. You spray in a surfactant, which functionalizes the surface of the particles as they're being formed. You move down and you cool it here and you collect it down into a solution. Then you take a patterned surface and you dip it in here, and the surfactant coordinated particles that you generated, because the particles are very uniform, will self-assemble into a hexagonal-shaped material, a monolayer. And so that's why you call it a hero experiment, is because being able to thread the needle this many times and actually get the result you want happens rarely. But if you get it right, it's pretty cool. So it's a combination of top-down and a bottom-up self-assembly. So it's all aspects of nanomaterials manufacturing all into one single approach. So any questions on the manufacturing side before we get into some commercial examples?
Is that previous technique used in manufacturing, or is there a research?
So I don't know. I don't know. It looked like this method for manufacturing some arrays may work, but I don't know if it actually did. I know that because the silver clusters have been used so extensively, I know you gave an example of a pregnancy test that was using the optical properties of gold nanoparticles, rather. So I'm not sure if this method is being used or not. But I do think, I'm fairly sure that this, I'm trying to remember, Purdue University is where they developed the technique where you atomize, then you control the particle growth, and then you dose in your surfactant to get the surface functionalization. I know that had gone commercial, but whether or not they got to the point where they then developed the solutions and they do the dip self-assembly, I don't know. So, you know, there are some really awesome examples that I think they've launched in the last 15 years. And the breadth of the properties that people are taking advantage of with nanomaterials is pretty stunning. And it really, to me, it's whenever I was working on this presentation, I stepped back. I was like, this is a great time to be in this field. And it really is, because we're just starting to understand all the places where there can be positive impacts. So this is a incredibly funky and beautiful church, in Rome. And, if you've spent time there, you know that Rome is notorious for having little Vespas with all kinds of smog and dirt and particulate come off of all the vehicles that are there. It's very dense. And so the architects who developed this church, they're trying to find a way to prevent it from very quickly becoming a gray stained edifice. So there was a company that had developed a self-cleaning cement that was used to manufacture the entire church. And if you read about it in their literature, the literature of the company, it just says it has nano titanium dioxide in it that will photocatalyze the oxidation of smog and dirt and bacteria and mold that forms on its surface. And this is from a separate article, but here's an example of kind of side by side. This is an uncoated surface versus a silver titanium dioxide surface. And so the why and the how is interesting. So the titanium dioxide nanoparticles they're a semiconductor that have this manageable band gap. And whenever you get absorption of light, you kick an electron into the conduction band, and you can split water to generate this metastable peroxide. The peroxide then oxidizes the pollutants and NOx gas and inorganic compounds and bacteria. And so if you go to the website for the manufacturer of the cement, this is all they talk about. But if you actually study the material, you find out that they put usually 2-3% silver in there. They never mention it in their literature. And what we found is that, and there's some literature that's starting to show this, that the addition of silver nanoparticles is critical to getting that nano titanium dioxide self-cleaning effect. Because what happens is you plasmon sensitize the titanium dioxide, you actually reduce that band gap. So it's much more efficient in absorbing light. You get a much higher rate of photooxidation. So adding just a small amount of silver photocatalyst is the key to really making this an efficient process. And this is a method for evaluating the band gap, where you do your UV vis and then you rearrange it. And if you plot it, you can determine what your band gap is. And the bottom line is the silver contributes to the reducing of the band gap, and that's what gives you the higher efficiency. In the biological world, there's been an absolute ton of nanosensing patents that are, I think, just now kind of maturing to the point where we're starting to appreciate the value of them. This company, Aurasense, was founded by Chad Merkin, who was just here on campus a week ago. I don't know if anyone saw him talk, but he's a professor of chemistry from Northwestern University, who's done a very good job of inspiring the commercialization of a lot of biological materials. Did I mention he got his doctorate here at Penn State? So he got his doctorate here at Penn State. And in the last 10 years, his chemistry publications around nanoscience have been the most referenced in the entire globe. So he's done an incredible job of developing some chemistry. He also does a fantastic job of marketing his chemistry. He's done that very well, and this is an example of that. Millipore, which is a huge company that makes primarily filtration media, but they also do biological assays. So he's developed a technique for functionalizing gold particles, living cells that are dosed in. This particular particle will sense RNA, it produces something called that they call a flare, which is basically a fluorophore. It's an easier way to do live cell RNA assays. And so this is a commercial product manufactured by a company outside of Chicago. Another area that's growing quite rapidly is the area of enhanced reactivity using zero valent iron for contamination remediation. So what we know about iron metal is that it likes to rust, right? We know that you can see iron rust really quickly, actually. And if you make it into nanoparticles, it rusts really, really quickly. But what is rusting? It's the iron being oxidized, which means something else has to be reduced, whatever's in contact with it. And if you pump zero valent ion nanoparticles into contaminated groundwater, for example, so let's say you've got residual hydrocarbons or halogenated carbons, when they come in contact with zero valent iron, they'll be reduced to something reactive like an alkene, and the toxicity drops way down. Same thing with metals like lead. We really don't want them to be ionized because they can distribute in groundwater very quickly. When they're ionized, we can reduce them back to iron zero. They become a lot less mobile. So this is something that was just kind of an R&D thought about 15 years ago. But there are some companies now that are going into what are more or less Superfund sites, where you may have had a halogenated hydrocarbon. Let's see. So here's an example. You have a leaky tank and it contaminated all this groundwater. Well, using techniques that aren't very different than contemporary fracking techniques, you drill down and you pump zero valent iron into the ground, and it will move through the contamination plume and react with the halogenated carbon and heavy metals that are down there, immobilize them. And then typically they'll do sampling downstream, and in some cases, because of the pressure there, they've got to vent it. But it's a very promising way to clean up contaminated sites. A good friend of mine from graduate school actually works for this company. He's their VP of R&D. So it's a very exciting time for them because they're just moving through their regulatory hurdles. Because you can imagine your approach is, all right, we want to take lots and lots of nanoparticles and pump them into an area that's contaminated. They want to understand what the maybe unintended consequences of a process like that may be. So they've moved through that, and now are in a very good place and growing rapidly. So considering that we've had winter for the last 8 months straight, applications like this are useful. This is a new designer glove that's made out of leather that has the fingers and thumb sensitized with a combination of silver nanoparticles and carbon black, so that it functions with a capacitive touchscreen. And what's interesting is that the typical approach would be to put a little conductive metal tape or to sew in. I think everyone's seen the metal threads that you can put on there. They can be silver. They can be stainless steel. Here, they take particles, and in the same process whereby they can the leather, they infuse the silver into the digits. At least that's what a glove maker I know told me. And are able to get enough conductance in the digits so that you can use it even using your knuckle. So it's an area that is not quite the same as nanomedicine, but it's useful. And interestingly enough, you just don't have any of the limitations you do when you got a little chunk of metal on your finger. So energy, I know that there's an upcoming presentation, lecture on nano and energy. But catalysis is going to play an increasing role in my opinion, of allowing us to merge, different, energy approaches to give us a more efficient energy infrastructure here in the U.S. And Air Products, which are, they're based in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which isn't too far from here, they've developed a method for using nano copper catalysts for converting carbon dioxide to methanol over with hydrogen, just going over a zinc oxide support with copper on it. And so they can convert carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide to methanol. And methanol, of course, can be used as a liquid fuel. If you take this to the next step, and there's been a very interesting project going on at the Department of Energy. So if you take carbon dioxide and hydrogen, you can use solar energy to get the sufficient heat required to run the reaction to generate methanol that could be used as a fuel. And then I was just recently reading an article that extends this even further, and you can kind of let your imagination wander a little bit. So, okay, we use solar energy to get the temperatures we need to run this reaction. Envision the carbon dioxide coming from natural gas fuel generation, right? So you're burning natural gas to generate power. You can also generate hydrogen from splitting water with a wind turbine. And so it was proposed that if you start clustering these energy techniques where you're using a wind turbine to split water, the hydrogen is separated from the oxygen using some type of a nanomembrane. The hydrogen is mixed with the output from burning the natural gas, and then you use solar energy to convert the output of your wind turbine and your natural gas into a fuel that's burnable by an automobile. And when you start thinking about clustering these different techniques and complementing them, you start seeing that nanomaterials can play a really important role, whether it be in filtration, whether it be as a catalyst to allow these things to interconvert. But if you let your mind wander and you think about 50 years from now, more sophisticated ways to cluster our energy infrastructure, there's some really exciting possibilities.
Isn't the efficacy of this very dependent on the particle shape?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how are you going to control, you know, in general, the particle shapes? That's very difficult.
You know, it's you're absolutely right. And so, you know, we were talking about the flame methodology for producing it, and you get some control there, right, as you adjust the parameters. So, you know, just as you were saying, you know, nanorods versus spheres are going to have very different surface energies, especially when you have things like corners and edges. And so all of that is areas that have to be explored. And then the other thing that I know, you know, from friends who work in this area, purification methods of your inputs can, if you do those right, you can find efficiencies in this area that you didn't even know you had, because sometimes the impurities will swamp the effect of shape. So combining purification techniques like nanofiltration on the front end can allow you to get higher sensitivity in these areas. But you're absolutely right. You know, that's the frontier of catalysis, is exploring how size, shape control, and crystal structure, each of those is going to impact your rate of catalysis and the durability of your catalyst. So my company, the company I work for, Nano Horizons, as I said, was founded by Professor Fonash. We manufacture nanoscale silver additives that are used in textiles, fibers, medical devices. We surface functionalize our particles, and in some cases we encapsulate them in proprietary polymers that allow them to be processed in melt flows, like in an extruder, so you can injection mold apart. And we brand the product under the Smart Silver brand. And if you look closely, you'll see that we've done a fairly good job of hiding the Penn State logo in there a little bit. So silver has been used in antimicrobial applications for millennia. But we're really only beginning to really to understand the mechanism. And it's a multi-pronged mechanism that always flows through the silver ion. So there are a number of ways to create silver ions. A small silver particle with a high surface area will oxidize and generate a silver ion. When it comes in contact with a bacteria, it will react with sulfur, sulfur-based proteins that are in the cellular membrane. It prevents replication of the bacteria and also can shut down metabolic pathways. And so it's useful in areas like medical scrubs. So we worked with a company called Greenology and launched a set of medical scrubs called Do No Harm. And this is a SEM that shows cotton fibers that have silver particles that have been covalently bonded to the cotton using dye molecules. Another attribute that I don't think in the textile world has been sufficiently explored is unique ability of nanoparticles to be integrated into very fine, high-performance fibers. This is an example of electrospun nanofibers that are 300 nanometers across. They're produced at the Kyoto Institute in Japan. And they were able to electrospin our silver nanoparticles into these fibers. And you can see discrete particles throughout the fiber. So quite clearly, if you'd had larger particles, there's no way to embed them into the fiber and still have the same tensile strength, mechanical properties that you'd want. Larger particles would kill your tensile properties. And so nanofibers like this are currently being explored for things like antiviral face masks. So because a virus is so small, having a non-woven that's used in a mask that has very fine pores is advantageous over traditional non-wovens. The area where we're seeing, I think, the most pressing need for improved antimicrobial performance is in the medical field. And that's because of existing problems with hospital-acquired infections. And so the approach to evaluating something like this is a traditional catheter. If you wanted to test it to see, okay, does it kill bacteria or not? The typical approach would be to cut off a section of it, put it into a petri dish, and see whether or not the bacteria that are floating around it are killed by the elution of silver ions out of the device if you've impregnated it. But the problem is that in a clinical setting, whenever a medical device is colonized, it forms a biofilm. And biofilms are basically a collection of bacteria that have excreted an exoskeletal layer, a polymer, that physically prevents them from being moved off the surface and also protects them chemically. So it's like a coral reef for bacteria to hide. And that's the method by which most medical devices, if you're going to get an infection, it's going to be through the formation of biofilm. And so we've done a lot of work to develop methods to evaluate whether or not a device is resistant to biofilm and then tested nanosilver against biofilm to see whether or not it can break down biofilm. And the bottom line is these are catheters that we developed. And so this is just your floating bacteria, no catheter. This is a normal catheter. with no silver in it. And then if you put nanoscale silver into the catheter, and you put them in this biofilm test. So this is just your traditional planktonic bacteria test. And this is number of days, so 1, 2, 3, 4 days. You can envision a catheter being in someone's heart or a pick that would go through their arm for 4 days is a quite common length of time for someone to be catheterized. So if we start with a high amount of bacteria, you'll see in a traditional catheter, that'll stay and persist, and you're very likely to have an infection and maybe sepsis at the end of 4 days under those conditions. Where if you put the silver in, you see a drop off, and at the end of 4 days, you've got almost a four. Now, this is a log scale, right? So this is a four log reduction, so 10,000 times less. So it's a really substantial drop off. On the biofilm side, so this is evaluating the bacteria that are kind of floating around the catheter. This is actually looking at what attaches onto the catheter, and this is what's really problematic from a clinical standpoint. And we see in 24 hours you get some attachment to the silver base, but you get two orders of magnitude higher attachment to a traditional catheter. And then at the end of 4 days, again, you're three logs, about 1,000 times more attachment here. And this is data that we can share. We've got other data that was developed with some of our industrial partners, medical device manufacturers, where you get much better resistance. But the point is, you can embed your nanoscale silver into these devices. They have all the mechanical properties that you want. And for a catheter, it's got to have flexibility. It's got to have tensile strength. So we've been able to get very nice results. And we were just down at FDA 3 weeks ago presenting this preliminary data and describing the test method because it's very leading edge to talk about quantifying biofilm as opposed to quantifying just the bacteria floating in a petri dish. And just, I wanted to be timely. I saw this article come out on March 29th, so it's not quite 3 weeks old. But DuPont recently entered into the nano silver conductive materials for organic LED lighting. They just entered that market. Actually, they're planning to enter the market next year. But this is an area with explosive growth right now. And the conductive inks, it's an area that's been around for a while, but the demands of the materials are starting to challenge it even more. The general idea is you start with some type of a precursor colloidal silver ink, and then you go through a low temperature anneal or sinter, and you get a conductive material that has larger crystallites, and you get the enough contact where you can get an electrical charge. What's interesting about using the nanoparticles here is that, one, the smaller particles can be deposited through an inkjet, right? Because an inkjet has a very fine nozzle. If you had larger particles you wanted to lay down to make interconnects, you can clog your inkjet. So, but if you're able to get the fine particles, you can use cheaper manufacturing techniques like inkjet. You can bring down the cost of manufacturing. The other thing that is fascinating, of course, and this is something that I know Professor Fonash talked about earlier, is the melting temperature of metals drops off considerably as you get into the nanoscale. And so here, when you get below 60 nanometers, you get a nice tail off in the sintering temperature. And that's important because if you wanted to, do inkjet printing and then anneal on a piece of paper, well, if the piece of paper burns up before you get the proper sintering to get the conductivity, then you failed. So by going to smaller particles, you bring down the sintering temperature, and you're able to get access to some materials like Kapton. We're still not down in here where we can regularly print on things like paper yet and get the proper sintering, but it's the right idea. You use the nanoscale to access the lower sintering temperatures, and that opens up new substrates that you can use for manufacturing. And you get the added bonus of being able to use cheaper printing methods.
Do you have any idea what DuPont's doing to be able to make a superior ink? Are they doing a better job of controlling the particle size, do you think?
From my experience, the thing that the particles aren't the hard part. It's the polymer stabilizers that allow you to be fluidized and remain dispersed, but then very cleanly vaporize in your sintering step and don't oxidize your silver, because whenever you go from silver metal to silver oxide, you lose your conductivity. Mm-hmm. So I think their magic is not so much in the particle formation. It's the ink chemistry, the polymer stabilizer chemistry, and having it be able to burn cleanly. That's the part that we've done some work in this area. And we've been able to get some reasonably good sintering temperatures, but we don't get a clean burn off of our polymers. So, it's something that's worthy of a survey, but, you know, it's something that requires a lot of attention. But they've done well in that area. So, the goals today, of course, were to take you, through a historical tour, talk a little bit about the sticky points around definitions and just kind of raise your antennas to that, just so it's something that you're aware of as you hear talk of definitions now and in the future. Go over some of the manufacturing methods and then talk about the properties and real-world examples. And thank you for your time. I like this cartoon. I don't know if you see over here, but this is War and Peace, and it's smaller than the principles of nanotechnology. But, if you think about why the principles of nanotechnology would be so large, it's because if you think about what we just talked about, biology, catalysis, nanoelectronics, I mean, it's really at the center of so much what's going on today. That to fully understand it, yeah, it's a big book, but it's a book worth reading. Thank you for your time.